Well, let's look back together then at Psalm 36. Psalm 36 there in our Bibles. I'll give it the title, From Despair to Prayer and Praise. From Despair to Prayer and Praise. Psalm 36. It begins in verse 1 as David ponders the transgression of the wicked. Verse 1, an oracle within my heart. A pondering, it could be. He's thinking about these things. What was it that forced him to? That made him consider those things? Maybe it was something personal. Maybe something had happened to David that week or that day. We know something of the life of David, although not, of course, when this psalm was set. Maybe it was an attack upon him. Maybe it was one of the evil acts that Saul directed towards him. Maybe it was a betrayal. It was once the time when David went to rescue a city, and then he heard that Saul was on the move, and he asked the Lord, well, are these people going to betray me? God said, yes, time to go. Was he reflecting on something like that? After he had done good to somebody, they turned their back on him and were about to betray him. Or the betrayals he faced from his own sons, in fact, and others of his close friends. Was it something personal? Did he hear of some wicked plan? Was it something that affected somebody else? Did he hear of evil being done to somebody else? Perhaps even after the death of Saul, who was wicked in many of his ways, and yet how David grieved deeply when he heard of the cruel way the Philistines had treated him, well, even his body and so on. Was it something in the national news that David heard of something happening or somewhere far away? And he began to ponder the pain of human wickedness. That's the first thing we have here in this psalm, isn't it? As David ponders the pain of human wickedness. And maybe we do that. Maybe we're in that sort of place this evening. Maybe it's something personal, something that's happened to us, the way we've been treated badly. Maybe it's something that's happened to somebody else, a loved one, or somebody that we know, and they've described some calamity that has befallen them, something because somebody's done great evil to them. Or maybe it's something in the news, something we hear about happening nationally or internationally. We hear of terrorist attacks. We hear of the shameful treatment of God's people in various parts of the world, as God's people are ridiculed and humiliated, brutally treated and put to death. Do we ever hear of those kind of news? Either something personal, something to somebody else, something in our country or something far afield. And we hear of something and it shakes us to the core of our being. And just as David was thinking about the evil things people do, can we do that sometimes? We can be forced by circumstances to think about things. And we're shaken, aren't we, with questions like, how could they? What drove them to do such wickedness? Why did they treat us that way? Or why did they treat somebody else like that? How could they do it? How could they do something so evil? And David begins to ponder that here in this psalm, the first four verses. And the root of it that David comes to is there in verse 1. There is no fear of God before his eyes. That's at the root of this. How could they do something like this? Betray him, or a murder that takes place, or a terrorist attack? How could they do something like that? Because they don't fear God. And the word he's thinking about is a real, almost a terror of God. It's not talking about sort of a trusting fear. He's almost saying that they've got no terror of God. They don't care less. They've got no dread of death. They might occasionally have a thought about facing judgment, but they just go straight out one ear and out the other, as it were. They don't care less. Think nothing of God. Don't mind at all. No terror of hell, no thought of punishment, and therefore they fear no consequence to their actions. There's no fear of God before their eyes. They either think God is powerless, or perhaps they deny his existence at all. This leaves them without the tiniest sort of shred of any concern of what God may think of their deeds. And then in verse 2, he moves on. Well, they have no fear of God in before their eyes. Well, with their eyes instead, verse 2, they flatter themselves. So they don't fear God, and then they flatter themselves. That is what they've done in their own eyes, as he keeps saying, is that they've inflated themselves and deflated God. They've made God nothing or small, and they've made themselves big. They've made themselves great. They're the number one. They flatter themselves. Maybe there's a self-confidence that comes with that. They can do anything. A sense of bravado, perhaps. They've got away with evil actions before, and there's no consequences for their actions. They can do whatever they like. Maybe an idea of self-determination. Whatever I choose to do, I can do it. I can be whoever I want, and no comeuppance for it. Maybe it's an aspect, too, of flattering himself to justify their actions. Again, you sometimes hear these things, don't you, when we have one of these, alas, murders on the streets in some of our cities, and we go out with a knife and so on, and or a terrorist attack, and you sometimes, the police will sort of try and unravel the background of what went on in their home life. Look at the videos they posted on the internet, all sorts of stuff like this. And often there is a sort of bizarre way that they've flattered themselves and turned everything upside down, turned the evil things they've done and somehow called them good. They end up with their own sort of bizarre, twisted morality, so-called. Often a flattery and a desire for freedom, a license to do whatever they like. Well, David looks at what's going on. The second bit of verse 2, for he finds out his iniquity and when he hates. A little bit hard trying to work out the exact sort of phrase there and how that makes sense. But, you know, he's somebody who's full of hatred, isn't he? Someone who's full of this iniquity that's been mentioned already. Full of hatred. Verse 3 talks about his wicked words, the words of his mouth, the wickedness and deceit. That's their transgression. They have words of wickedness, that sort of outright evil, and words of deceit, that sort of underhand evil. You know, sometimes they're blatant in what they do, and other times they're just deceptive and manipulative about what's going on and so on. And they lie, they say one thing but do the opposite. Their words are those of deceit. He ceased to be wise and to do good. Nothing wise in his actions anymore, as we've been thinking in the book of Proverbs. Nothing good at all. And they plan even more evil. Verse 4. He devises wickedness on his bed. He sets himself in a way that's not good. He does not abhor evil. They seem content to plan and dream up more wickedness. It's again often the way that sometimes comes to the surface after one of these murders or shootings that happens or something like that. And again, the police will sort of raid their home address and they'll sometimes find there, you know, books and plans for yet more evil they've planned to do if they could get away with it. And sometimes if they get away with one action, they'll plan something bigger, won't they? And the like. They seem not satisfied with one evil act, but instead just automatically move on to something else. Well, what a sad topic. What a sad topic that David ponders at the beginning of his psalm. I say we're not quite sure what drove him there, what circumstances, what situation. But perhaps it's something that we contemplate from time to time, whether it's things in the news or things that affect us personally. But so often can lead to despair, can't it? Thinking about the acts of the wicked, they seem to get away with it, they seem to just be after more, can lead us to doubt, can't it? And confusion. And it's a theme that comes up in the Psalms and elsewhere in God's Word as they contemplate these things and wrestle with these things. Well, there's a time and a place for that, as David does, for the first four verses. And then he stops. It's quite abrupt, isn't it, if you notice as we read in the psalm. The first four verses are about this topic of the wicked. Verses 5 and 6 onwards take a drastically different course, don't they? There's a time and a place to ponder wickedness. And there's a time and a place to stop. And that's what David seems to do. He's there thinking about these evil acts that he's witnessed or heard of. And then David stops. And sometimes we need to do that, don't we? We can get ourselves into a declining sort of pattern of thought, and we just almost end up wallowing in it, thinking about all of these horrible things, the way we've been treated, the way others are treated. We hear things on the news, we hear in the persecuted church, and sometimes we can almost be swamped by those things and feel driven to despair and confusion. But sometimes there's a time to stop. That's what David does. I said, almost, right, enough of that. I've thought about that, and that did need to be done. But let's think about something else. And so the second thing we see in this psalm is David praising the precious character of God. It's a beautiful couple of verses, verses 5 and 6, aren't they? Your mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. Your righteousness is like the deep mountains. Your judgments are a great deep. David thinks of four character traits of God. His mercy, his faithfulness, his righteousness, and his judgments. Four characteristics of God as he pauses and praises this character of God. And he thinks of four ways to describe how huge those things are. So your mercy, O Lord, to the heavens, he says. Mercy to the heavens. That's what David thinks about. Think of the heavens, the stars, the solar system, the planets, the universe beyond it. Mankind send off their probes, don't they, into space. And they travel out past Mars and Saturn and Jupiter, taking photos as they go and measuring things and the like. But there always seems more to find, doesn't there? And it takes these probes years and years to get to these places. And, you know, if we waited years and years more, perhaps they'd get even further and find more. But it's like God's mercy. Your mercy to the heavens. There's always more to discover. There's more and more of God's mercy. It stretches out like the stars in heaven. Your faithfulness, that was the second characteristic. Your faithfulness to the clouds, he says. Maybe he was thinking of some of the towering clouds we've seen recently in some of our stormy weather. We went for a walk this afternoon, and the heavens open, and then another time it was sunny, kept going in and out. And there's massive black clouds there on the horizon. Your faithfulness like the clouds, vast, stretching above us. We have a different perspective sometimes when you go on holiday, don't you? And you're on an aeroplane above the clouds. Well, David never saw that from that way. But these clouds, they're there just sort of towering up like huge mountains and the like. Perhaps as well, he thinks of faithfulness to the clouds because in the Bible, those are often linked. God's faithfulness is seen in the weather, like the covenant he made to Noah, that there'll be summer and winter and springtime and harvest. And how it tells us that God sends the sun and the rain upon the good and the wicked. That's part of his faithfulness, isn't it? Your faithfulness to the clouds. And God's faithfulness is seen in the weather that he brings. It's all under his control. But unlike the weather, it's unchangeable. It's faithfulness that's beyond the clouds. Whether the sun is shining or the clouds are bringing rain or there's howling great winds around us, even this weekend, God's faithfulness is steadfast, isn't it? Faithfulness beyond the clouds. Third one, your righteousness. Your righteousness like the great mountains. Thinking back of the wild weather we've had and how everything can get thrashed around, can't it, by these winds. As you've seen some of the trees that have fallen over and been dragged out the way of the roads and the like and chopped up with a chainsaw and things, you know, and perhaps you've been there in your car driving along through one of these windy times and the car's sort of bumping around on the road and sort of lurching around on it and more things we've seen perhaps on the news. But the mountains, the Thorpe Cloud, still there. And the winds have howled across it. You journey up into Scotland or to the Alps, or go and see the Himalayan mountains, they're the same as they were the day before the storm. God's righteousness is like the mountains. It's immovable. It's steadfast. doesn't change. God's righteousness is the same. Fourth one, your judgments, well, they're like a great deep. Goes the opposite way, sort of thinks downwards this time. Your judgments like the great deeps are the depths of the sea. And still to this day, they're some of the most unexplored parts of the world. Scientists tell us that are just a mere couple of percent of actually the depths of the ocean have been explored, just in a couple of areas. They are something unfathomable. And imagine even more so for David, who'd never seen a submarine or anything like that, or heard of such a thing. Your judgment's like the great deep. That unexplored, unfathomable depths of the ocean that you just guess as you look overboard, the side of the boat as it was, at how deep it could be. So it is with God's judgment. Mysterious to us. Unfathomable. Just something we are literally out of our depth as we think about. These four character traits he thinks of, and these four little pictures. The heavens, the clouds, the mountains, the deeps of the ocean. He finishes at verse 6. O Lord, you preserve man and beast. I think perhaps he's thinking about in those verses 5 and 6 about God's mercy, faithfulness, righteousness and judgment to all. To all the people he's created. Not just that, to all human beings. He mentions the beasts that God preserves through his mercy and his faithfulness. He preserves the lives of the animals. He preserves the lives of all of the people are on the earth. Then in the verses that follow, he seems to think more about God's people and the blessings that come to them, especially how precious it is, he says, verse 7, how precious is your loving kindness, O God. How precious it is that we can trust his loving kindness. He thinks of those of the children of men who put their trust under the shadow of your wings. He's thinking about God's people. And for them, they know his mercy, faithfulness, righteousness and judgments. But even more than that, there's something precious that they've discovered. And what a precious thing it is that we can trust God's loving kindness. And he picks up five more pictures in the little bits that follow. Just very, very brief little ones, really. Therefore, the children of men put their trust under the shadow of your wings. He pictures these different things. It seems that the pain of his pondering seems to be long forgotten. Although it was only a verse or two before. All the evil of the wicked and the despair and doubt that seem to be driving him towards. Now David says, how precious it is that we can trust in God and be under the shadow of his wings. He pictures perhaps what happened in the tabernacle. You might remember in the most holy part of the tabernacle there was that golden box, the ark. And on it were carved out of wood and laid in gold two angels, two cherubim. And they had their wings outstretched, a sort of shadow over the box. And there was the mercy seat, under the shadow of their wings. That's where the priest would go and offer that blood there on the mercy seat. It was the place of the covenant. So under the shadow of the wings is the place of God's covenant. It may also be a picture, as Jesus uses, of a mother hen who longs to gather her chicks under her wings to protect them. Sometimes you'll see animals doing that, won't they? Protecting their young from a potential threat. That's what a mother hen would do. Gather her chicks under her wings, perhaps pull out her wings and try and scare off, or you know, willing to sacrifice herself. If there was a dog on the loose or a fox or something like that. And all of these pictures find their fullness in Jesus, don't they? How precious it is that those who trust in God are there under the shadow of his wings. And Jesus, of course, when he died on the cross, it was no accident that he was nailed there with his arms outstretched. We trust under the shadow of Jesus' wings, don't we? We come to the cross where Jesus' arms were stretched out like wings. It's there we put our trust, isn't it? In the place of the covenant. Under the wings, under the shadow of God's wings. There's one precious picture for us. When we feel so threatened or so disturbed by the things we see around us, that's where we have our safe place, under the shadow of his wings. Second little picture, we're satisfied in your house. Verse 8, they are abundantly satisfied with the fullness of your house. The picture there is of coming to God's house and being satisfied, probably thinking of food. Back to the tabernacle again, which David may have been thinking of, where the priests were allowed to eat sometimes. Some of the sacrifice was given to God. Some of it went to supply the priest's needs. And the priest could eat. There was one time when David was on the run and he ate some of the bread in the tabernacle. And yet here it's all of God's people. They are. All of these people who put their trust in God. They're abundantly satisfied with the fullness of your house. Have you been on holiday recently, or that you can remember? What do you do when you arrive at a holiday home you've hired for the weekend? What do you do? What do you do when you arrive, when you unlock the door and there's the holiday house you've hired? What's the first thing you do? Go on, Elliot, what do you do?
Go around.
Now, our boys always explore. They've got to go and explore every room of the house, haven't you? Because it's our house for the weekend. And you go and have a look around. Ooh, there's a living room. There's the sofa. What's in the fridge? Probably nothing. Where's the bedrooms? What's the view like out the window? There's the excitement, isn't there, as you go to a house that's all yours for a bit. Even more so, perhaps if you are very posh and go to a hotel, because then all sorts of things are provided for you that you've paid for. But you go up to the room and the bed's all made and there's complimentary tea and coffee, isn't there? And perhaps you stay the night and you go down for breakfast in the morning and there it is on the table. It's all yours. It's a little bit like that here. Abundantly satisfied with the fullness of your house. It's all ours because God has welcomed us in to his house. And there's the fullness. Everything you could want, God has given to us. Of course, these things, as we've been saying, are fulfilled in Jesus. Satisfied with the fullness that comes from God's house. Perhaps it was that kind of idea that when Jesus talked about being the bread of life, the one who could satisfy, the one who could bring life and fullness to people. We're satisfied because God gave his son to us. He's the bread of life. As it says in one of our hymns, he's all I'll ever need. Satisfied with the fullness of your house. And a picture perhaps of heaven as well. To be there in God's house. In the real tabernacle. When we'll live with God. When we'll be welcomed in and we'll run around. Like little children on holiday. Going, is this ours? And not just for a holiday. It's ours forever. The mansions that have been prepared for us, satisfied with the fullness of God's house. Third little picture, you give them to drink from the river of your pleasures. The picture there, not so much of food, moves on to that of drink. We can drink from the river. Oh, alas, things are too polluted these days to actually often do that, aren't they? To go up somewhere in the country and just sip a bit out of a little stream coming down and the like. Oh, that refreshing, bubbling, cold water. Wow. Here we can imagine it at least. We can drink from the river of your pleasures. Funny thing is, that word literally is the same as the Garden of Eden. The word Eden means pleasures. So these are the rivers from Eden, you could translate it. That picture of where God lived with Adam and Eve and walked with them, at least for a little while. The river that flows from Eden. From the presence of God. The river that comes from him. And we can drink from it. Jesus, of course, again, took up this language and called himself the living water, didn't he? As he talked with the woman at the well at the beginning of John's Gospel. Of the living water that can bubble up within. You give us to drink from the river of your pleasures, finding pleasure, not our pleasures, but pleasures in what God has given us, and pleasures of God himself as we spend time in his presence. And again, that picture is taken up in Revelation, isn't it? There's a river flowing out of the city where God lives that brings life to all. Picture of that same idea. Verse 9 links to it. You're the fountain of life. For with you is the fountain of life. Again, we thought of Jesus being the living water already. He's the source of life. This water comes up, this living water comes up like a bubbling fountain from Jesus himself. As John will tell us at the beginning of his gospel, in him was life. He's the fountain of life. Everything that exists, exists because of him. And fifth one, in your light, we see light. He's the one who brings light to all. He's the one who's the light of the world, as Jesus himself would say. And in your light, we see light. Because when there isn't light, then you have to use something yourself, don't you? You don't need a candle to help you see the sun. Because when the sun's out, you don't need the candle. In your light, we see light. When God's light is shining, we see light. When we see the truth of the Lord Jesus Christ, the one who is the light of the world, in him was life, and that life was the light of men. There are these five precious pictures of God's loving kindness, ways it can talk about all that God has provided for his people, all that God means and should mean to his people. All of these ways, it points to the relationship we have with him, both now in the eternal life he's given us and in the absolute fullness of that life when we'll be with him in glory. It seems strange to almost think, where did this come from, these couple of verses? They came out of David's pondering about the wicked. And yet he stopped all that and he paused instead to consider the wonders of God's character and praised him for those precious things that meant so much to David and should be so much to us. And then lastly, in the last couple of verses, David prays. Prays for the protection and presence of God. Verse 10, oh, continue your loving kindness to those who know you and your righteousness to the upright in heart. He was thinking, verse 7, about how precious is your loving kindness. These are these things we're beginning to understand. Verse 10, Lord, continue your loving kindness to those who know you, those who are your people, those who know you, those who love you. The upright, he calls them, your righteousness to the upright in heart. Those who've been made upright by that forgiveness that comes from God under the shadow of his wings at the cross. Those who've been made upright. Those who know and love God. What does David pray? That they would know more of God's loving kindness and righteousness. Continue your loving kindness. Don't stop. Don't hold back. Just because we've come to realise your loving kindness is precious, verse 7, doesn't mean we've had enough. It is precious what we've known so far, but we want more of it, is what David says. Continue your loving kindness. Because if God were to stop that flow of living water, that would be it, wouldn't it, for us? If God were to decide not to be loving kind anymore, well, that's an end for us. David prays, continue your loving kindness. That stream of living water carried on, bubbling along towards us, that we may still receive from the fullness of your house, that we still may be welcome under the shadow of your wings. We need it more and more. We need more of the presence of God. Those who know you, we need to know you more. That's his prayer, isn't it? That we would know God more, know more of his presence, know more of his loving kindness. That's what will help us in our troubles as we live through this world, with the ups and downs and the gloom we can sometimes be thrown into when we see the wickedness of others, perhaps? What's the remedy for that? It's looking to God, isn't it? It's discovering yet more of the goodness of his house, the fullness of his loving kindness. He prays too for protection, verse 11. Let not the foot of pride come against me, and let not the hand of the wicked drive me away. So he prays, please continue your loving kindness and righteousness to us. He prays as well, protect me from evil. Protect me from evil. Perhaps he thinks as well of protect me from evil people. Perhaps that's the link to the beginning. Let not the foot of pride come against me and the hand of the wicked drive me away. Those hands and feet that are being used for evil. Perhaps David is concerned that some of these wicked that he's mentioned in the first couple of verses, they'll come and try and drive him away. They'll bring their heel against him, try and drive me away, presumably from God. Deliver me from evil, from those who would seek to ruin my relationship with God. Maybe it's protect me from evil within as well. Not just from other people, but from within. Let not the foot of pride come against me or the hand of the wicked. Maybe David is praying, let not my foot be raised up in pride. Let not my hand be taken over with wickedness. Protect me from the evil that's within. And those desires that are there which would quickly get the upper hand. Let not my foot rise up in pride. It's a bit like, isn't it, the end of the Lord's Prayer. Deliver us from evil. That's what David prays as he comes to an end of his psalm. He's been thinking about the wickedness of people. He's been thinking about the precious character of God. And that drives him to pray that he'd know more of God's character and that he would be protected from that evil. Whether that's the evil effects of others and their intentions, or the evil that's bubbling there in this old man, isn't it? Yes, we do love the Lord and want to follow him, but still so many of those things are there. Those evil desires in our hearts. And David can rest. Verse 12, there the workers of iniquity have fallen. They've been cast down and not able to rise. David can rest. Secure in God's justice. It says the workers of iniquity will fall. They have been cast down. They're not able to rise. It's certain they won't get away with their wickedness. Your judgments are a great deep, remember. Verse 6. God's judgment is mysterious and strange and unfathomable. But we do know he's just in those judgments. And so David can conclude, knowing that he is secure. He sees the trouble of the wicked, but he knows God will do what is right. That God will act in just the right way. That there will be punishment for those who do such evil things. But for those who trust in God's loving kindness, those who confess their sins and come to the shadow of his wings, will they discover this loving kindness that comes from God. And so David, in his trials, in his struggles, he realizes that the right remedy from despair about the wickedness of this world is found in the character of God. And as we think about him, we're helped to praise him as we should. And our prayer should be that he again would deliver us from evil, protect us, and bring us deeper into a relationship with him, that we might know more of these precious pictures that David can describe, to be under his wings, to be there satisfied within the fullness of his house, drinking from the river that comes from the presence of God, receiving from him the fountain of life and the one who is the light of the world. Let's sing together. Number 11 in our hymn books. It's, again, a bit of a paraphrase of half of the psalm. Psalm 36, sort of the second two-thirds of it. So we'll sing together. this psalm again, number 11 in our hymn books, and then we'll have a little bit of a time to pray together as well. Let's sing.